I graduated from Berkeley with a degree in creative writing and a vague notion about wanting to pursue a career that involved writing. But before surrendering to adulthood, I spent a mostly magical summer in Italy and Greece, first attending a college buddy's wedding in the Italian Alps, and then roaming around the Greek Isles with another friend. As Labor Day approached and my funds dwindled, I booked a ticket from Athens to D.C., landing in the nation's capital with not much more than a duffel bag of dirty clothes and a travel journal. I decided to head to Washington because that is where my siblings were, and I didn't have a better idea. First my sister and then my brother, both government lawyers, provided me food and shelter and helped me put together some semblance of a resume for my job search. This wasn't easy, given my spotty work history. Babysitter, camp counselor, greeting card author, a college roommate's father owned a greeting card company and had employed me to write sappy verses to accompany cloying animal photos. And singing telegrams entrepreneur. Another college buddy had talked me into going into business with her. A friend of my brother's, who was an editor in the Washington Post style section, passed along my resume to the woman at the Post in charge of hiring fresh-faced college grads, read easy prey, willing to work menial newsroom jobs. "You'll have to take it from here," Ellen, my brother's friend, had said when she told me she had gotten my resume to the right people, adding that if I got the job, I shouldn't tell anyone she had recommended me until I had proven myself. I was hired as a part-time copy aide. The phrase had recently come into use as a concession to the women's movement, but even I knew it was just a verbal sleight of hand for copy boy. Whatever the title, I was thrilled to have a real job, though I was still too young to appreciate the sheer serendipity that my first foray into the professional world was going exactly according to my hastily devised plan. My main duty was to answer phones and fetch whatever anybody on the style section staff needed, anything from clip files from the newsroom's library, which I was disappointed to learn was called the morgue only in the movies, to deliveries from bike messengers left at the front desk. The best part of the job was the phone answering. The copy aides were the reporters' lifelines to the outside world, with missed calls from elusive sources, needy children, and annoyed spouses rolling over to our phones. I liked taking messages because it gave me a sense of how the reporters actually worked. After a while, I began to figure out which ones were merely waiting for some PR flack to call, and which ones were working the phones themselves and developing their own sources. As lowly as the position was, the pace was frenetic with phones going off all the time, reporters constantly barking out requests, and the unsettling feeling I was supposed to be in two places at one time, especially when a deadline loomed. The one thing I didn't like in those early weeks was the way the head copy editor, whose job it was to lay out each page of the section, would yell at the top of his lungs for whichever one of us who was up next to grab the dummy, a long, thin sheet of paper, and run with it through the newsroom and down two floors via the creepy stairwell to the composing room where typesetters were waiting to lay out the next page. He would holler, "Dummy to go!" And if you were next, you had to jump up like you just heard a bullet shot out of a gun. I didn't object to the running, and I liked getting away from the chaos at the copy desk, but it was demeaning that we had to respond to someone yelling commands at us, like we were dogs being told to fetch. Also, it made us all nervous that we might hear someone scream out, "Dummy to go!" at any moment, and we might not be ready to go. Other than that, I didn't mind the grunt work. I basked in the reflected star power around me. The Washington Post newsroom in 1982 felt like a grand social science experiment being conducted on hundreds of idiosyncratic journalists with IQs north of 130. I was assigned to the highly regarded Styles section, a new, modern iteration of the women's pages, birthed in 1969 by the newspaper's famous editor, Ben Bradley, who came up with the idea of a section for an edgy, in-your-face kind of writing that would push the boundaries of where soft news writing could go, stylistically, tonally, and topically. Style would become an incubator for some of the most innovative and voicey and daring feature writing of its time, including that by Nicholas von Hoffman, Myra McPherson, Tom Shales, and Henry Allen. And there was Sally Quinn, who famously penned biting profiles of assorted Washingtonian types. Social climbers, players, takers, movers, and shakers. Even more famously, perhaps, Sally married Bradley. More on that later.